and we now leave the material of the prophet Isaiah ben Amos. His ministry ended at the end of the 8th century, so something like year 700. He'd witnessed the western expansion of Assyria, which pretty well conquered the whole of that narrow land corridor between the Arabian desert, which was uncrossable at that time, and the Mediterranean Sea. So, because he wanted to control Egypt as well. During the 600s, we're going to skip all this because it's not relevant to our material, Manasseh, the king, was king for something like 60 years. And from about 698 to about 640, something like that. Extraordinarily long period of stability. Stability because in Isaiah's time, the people from Samaria had hurried south for safety. Jerusalem, as you know, during his time was expanded onto the western hill. Hezekiah, the king at the time, did his best. He secured the water supply and he also built fortifications so that the expanded city would be at least have walls surrounding it. But he made some foolish decisions, thinking that Egypt might be better than Assyria. And so Assyria came in and just wiped out Judah and left the city of Jerusalem, as Isaiah said earlier, like a hut in the middle of a cucumber field, just sitting there. Well, during Manasseh's time, that is for most of the 600s, there was peace because Assyria was too strong, no one was offending them. They paid a price for this. They had to pay a lot of tribute to Assyria. And they also, the Assyrians came in and put the gods of the Assyrians in the temple. And so from a religious point of view, it was all over the place. But Judah gradually recovered economically. Then there was his grandson. His son took over, but only for a couple of years. His grandson, Josiah, took over the throne, and at this time Assyria was having trouble with the Parthians and other people over east. So Assyria was a bit caught up, so therefore less powerful. And Josiah the king took the opportunity, as he hoped, to regain for the promised land, to regain not Judah, what's the rest of it called?
Israel.
Israel, thank you. That is really a blank, isn't it? So to conquer Israel again, he hoped he'd do that. However, he himself went north to Megiddo to somehow confront the Egyptians at near Carchemish there and was murdered or assassinated. So that's the 600s. We now come to the end of the 600s, and I have a little bit of history to share with you. In 605, so a full 100 years after the time of Isaiah, the Babylonian army, Babylon, as you have seen on the map, is the southern part of Iraq, let's call it. The Babylonian army, led by Nebuchadnezzar, defeated the combined forces of Assyria and Egypt in the Battle of Carchemish. In 598, Nebuchadnezzar attacked Judah and besieged Jerusalem. The king, Jehoiakim, died during the siege. He was succeeded briefly by his 18-year-old son Jeconiah, sometimes called Coniah, who took the throne name Jehoiakim. He reigned for the first 3 months of 597, and wisely, he decided to surrender. Otherwise, the whole city would have been razed to the ground. He surrendered, the siege was lifted, and he was taken into exile into Babylonia, somewhere near Babylon, along with all the leading citizens, including the priest prophet Ezekiel, was one of them. Nebuchadnezzar replaced Jehoiakim, the young boy king, with his uncle Mattaniah, who was given the throne name Zedekiah. So all this happens in the opening years of the 500s. It's the period of Jeremiah, by the way, but we're not focusing on that. Now, we're looking at the period of exile now, over here, over in Babylon. And in the Babylonian Chronicles, so totally independent of the Bible, we read this. This is their account of what happened in Jerusalem. In the seventh year, the month of Kislev, the king of Arkad, the Akkadians, that's Babylon, mastered his troops, marched to the Hatti land, Canaan, and encamped against the city of Judah. And on the second day of the month of Adar, he seized the city, captured the king. He appointed there a king of his own choice, received its heavy tribute, and sent them to Babylon. A parallel account which fits exactly with the Bible story. In 594, Nebuchadnezzar had to put down an anti-Babylonian conspiracy in which Zedekiah, the king of Judah, was involved. A few years later, Zedekiah repeated the mistake made by his brother Jehoiakim and, encouraged by Egypt, withheld tribute. So in 588, the Babylonians besieged Jerusalem. Egypt's intervention was unsuccessful. Zedekiah attempted to escape but was captured and taken to Babylon, blind at first. Ravaged by famine, Jerusalem capitulated in 587, and a further group of the leading citizens, or anyone who'd be useful to the war effort in Babylon, were taken into exile and the city, including the temple, razed to the ground. The total number of deportees in both exiles is estimated at 4,600. People left behind were the ordinary farmers and people who had no value in the army or in the public service or anything like that. So they're left without leadership, and we really know nothing much what happens to them. Now, let's look at the Babylonian exile, out of which the chapters I'm about to share with you come. So this is the setting, and it's crucial, of course. The Babylonian exile demanded an enormous religious adjustment. In spite of all the hopes built upon promises understood to have come from God, the promised land had been taken from them. Despite the assurances that they had been given that Jerusalem would not be defeated by a foreign king, assurances that were reinforced when Sennacherib failed to capture the city back in 701, so they kept quoting that, look what God did, he saved us then, he'll absolutely certainly save us again. The Babylonian army, however, had razed the city to the ground, God's city and temple. Despite assurances that God would guarantee the dynasty of David, they lost their king. So there's no promised land, no city, no temple, no king. Despite assurances that God would guarantee the dynasty of David, they lost their king. And despite their belief that the temple was the house of God, Yahweh, it had been destroyed. Some said, well, the God of the Babylonians must be stronger than the God we've got. Others said, no, Yahweh was behind it. So you've got a theological effort going on there. Any national institutional basis for their religious identity had been swept away. If they were going to retain any sense of themselves as a people, talk about the exiles now, they had to discover a firmer base for their faith. They had to learn a new humility and find a deeper faith in God, independent of political and economic power. This is a bit of a distracting thought, but I've got it, so I'll share it. I wonder how people in Italy coped with the loss of the papal states and the Pope being confined to a little area called the Vatican. It will change your way of thinking. In Babylon, they found themselves living in what was in many ways a superior culture, but not religiously. The concept of monotheism, there's only one God, as distinct from what's called monolatry, worshipping only one God, began to emerge, as well as a sense of their missionary vocation. Religiously, Babylon was wonderful, but so poor religiously that awakened in them a sense that reawakened the old dream that we've got a responsibility to open these people up to the real God. So instead of identifying themselves in relation to the Davidic dynasty, which is gone, they began to see themselves as a community defined by worship. In the absence of the temple, they began to come together to remember and to pray. That's what the synagogue means, the assembling. In a hall, nothing big about it, no temple, no cult, no sacrifices, but they meet together to talk about their faith. In the absence of the temple, they began to come together to remember and to pray. This was the beginning of the institution of the synagogue, which has remained central to Judaism ever since. They had to ask themselves how the loss of land, the temple and the monarchy, how could this have happened? Don't forget the assumption. Obviously, God must have willed it. That's what they thought. So God must have a good purpose in it. We must have to change and repent and become what we're meant to be. So it was impossible for them to contemplate the possibility that their God, Yahweh, was weaker than the God of the Babylonians. So they concluded it must have been their God who brought about the catastrophe that they were experiencing. And since God is just, the problem had to be their infidelity to their part of the covenant. And they interpreted their loss and suffering as divine punishment for their sin, as God's way of purifying them. So, where have they gone wrong? What must they do to bring about the purification without which they couldn't enjoy God's blessing? These are some of the questions that were being asked by a number of different schools during the long years of exile. We're left to imagine the dialogue, the debate, the discussion that went on between these various schools and with the other concerned groups struggling to make sense of what had happened to them. One of the schools, which we'll just touch on, was the Deuteronomic school. And they were working on a comprehensive history, inverted commas, to reflect on what had gone wrong and to provide a guide for their future leaders, This is where the final edition of Joshua, Judges, Kings, Samuel and Kings were brought about in exile. They're doing a wonderful job. Another school we know about are the priestly school. The temple's gone, they can't do what they normally do in the temple because it isn't there. So they were working on composing an accurate record of the cult. Up till then, there's no record of the cult, basically, because if I were a priest, my eldest boy would be a priest automatically. So he'd learn, like farmers learn, or mothers learn, or husbands learn. They learn from their people before them. So they pick it up by watching and doing and learning and being shown what to do. That can't happen anymore because it's not happening anymore. So it was important and urgent that they write down, the priests write down what they had learned so that if ever they went back to the temple, they could carry on God's cult. Now, we've got this exile, we've got all this happening. A dramatic turn of events came with the victories of Cyrus of Persia. It's the Persian Gulf, which of course you know. The lower sea is what they call it. And there's Persia there on the eastern shore and northern near Elam. Well, Persia, and there's Babylonia there, nothing much, not a great distance as we're dealing with. And so the ailing Babylonian Empire was ruled by a usurper called Nabonidus. In 550, so halfway through the 500s, nearly 50 years after the exile had started, Cyrus of Persia conquered Ecbatana, capital of the Median Empire. 3 years later, he captured Sardis, which is off your map. It's over here, what we'll call eastern, western Turkey. Then he took Susa, the capital of Elam. News of Cyrus's victories and of his policy of allowing exiles to return to their homeland awakened a similar hope for the exiles from Judah. They were hearing about this Persian king who, when he conquered a land, allowed people to go back. He was not interested in, as the Assyrians and Babylonians were, in bringing people in. Now they could go back home, they could have their own gods. In fact, they even bankrolled the building of temples and things as long as they paid tax. That's what they wanted, money. Control the economic side of it. Well, if this is happening and they hear about it happening, of course when the news reaches the camps there in Babylon, they're thinking, maybe, we might be able, God must be doing this. In fact, Cyrus was seen as God choosing Cyrus to do this. He's in fact called the Messiah, even. So it's pretty high power. He's the promised one, the chosen one, not the final Messiah, but a Messiah. So all this is happening, and this hope is starting to awaken. And this is where the Isaiah school, I'm reluctant to call it that, it's a school of writers anyhow. They're not particularly related to the Isaiah the prophet. But since the material is put into the Isaiah scroll, I'll do that for. It's often assumed that the material found in the Isaiah scroll, chapters 40 to 55, is the work of an unnamed individual prophet called, for convenience, Deutero-Isaiah or Second Isaiah. And that may be how it is. However, in more recent times, I'm following those who attribute it to a school of prophet preachers, not a particular one prophet. These prophet preachers show familiarity with the Isaiah tradition, as they do with other prophetic and Deuteronomic material, but their writing has its own distinct character, and what it has most in common with is the Psalms. as you'll see in a few minutes' time. The temple singers, this group of people around who were around the temple back in Jerusalem and who created music and psalms for the worship of the people. It's likely that the oratorical nature of the material we're about to start reading is because it was composed for preaching in the synagogue. So it was precisely composed for, not the cult, because they didn't have a cult, but the best they could do for that, singing, remembering, capturing their understanding of Yahweh in song and in the use of the harp. These prophet preachers saw Cyrus as the instrument raised up by Yahweh, the Lord of creation and the Lord of history, to liberate his people. Their exile, which the Babylonians saw as proof of the superiority of their God over Yahweh, is presented by the Isaiah school as the victory for Yahweh, who raised up the Babylonian power to purify Judah, who had done that. Now, this same Yahweh, in fulfillment of earlier prophecies, was raising up another foreign power, Persia, to take his purified people back to the promised land. So we need to keep in mind the pressure the deported Judeans were under in this multicultural environment with its powerful imperial deities. And this helps account for the polemic against idols, but more importantly, for the stress throughout that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is the Lord of creation and the Lord of history. They have a much bigger view now of the role of this Yahweh. The writings of the Isaiah school, which I'll call it for a moment, in exile, fall into two distinct parts. The first part I'm going to start on now and finish tomorrow morning, and then the second part we'll do in the second part tomorrow morning. Part one is chapter 40 to 48. This material is nothing like anything we've read the Isaiah scroll. The prophet Isaiah carried out his ministry against the background of Assyrian aggression. The prophet Jeremiah ministered in the catastrophic years of the rise of Babylon and the collapse of Judah. These nine chapters of the Isaiah scroll promise an end to exile and a return to the promised land. They call for hope and trust and look forward to the excitement of taking part in a second Exodus. It's easy to pick up their excitement. They're going right back to Moses. The people were in Egypt, slavery, and Moses, God, through Moses, took them to the promised land. Here they are in slavery in Babylon, and a new Moses, and they talk about that, a new leader, has to take them across the desert again, once more, back to the promised land. So they call for hope and trust. And this time, Yahweh, the Lord of creation and the Lord of history, is coming not to punish, but to comfort and redeem. We have in these chapters an inspired response to the call to sing a new song. It's a call also to mission. I'm just about finished the introduction. I'm sorry it's so long, but I felt it was necessary. We'll grasp the message of Isaiah 40 through best if we place ourselves imaginatively among the exiles in Babylon. Join them in the synagogue. Listen to the words of these prophet preachers, to the tune of the harp, singing and reminding us of the depths of our faith. They've been told by Yahweh to comfort us, to assure us that we are indeed God's people. Through their prophetic words, Yahweh is calling us now in Babylon, in exile, calling us to share the good tidings with others. That'll become apparent as well. The joy of the gospel. Back to in Jerusalem, we heard so many disturbing words. And the terror of the siege and the occupation of the city by the Babylonian army and the deportation that we experienced proved that those disturbing words were indeed from Yahweh. When we hear these singers, these temple singers, use the expression, says your God, we know we're listening to a claim that it's Yahweh who's once again speaking to us, but this time to comfort. Isaiah 40, verses 1 to 2. Comfort. Comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Cry to her that she has served her term. Her penalty is paid. She has received from Yahweh's hand double for all her sins. The punishment seemed to be out of proportion. Yes, but God had a design in doing this, and we're about to hear what it is. So we, imagining ourselves as in exile, we've been struggling to make sense of the disasters that overtook Judah. Many of our parents have died in this God-forsaken Babylon, and our children have known nothing but exile. They've been in displaced persons' camps for as long as they can remember. The people of Palestine and many other parts of our world. Though living in Babylon, our hearts are in Jerusalem. And you know that lovely psalm, I can't remember the name, how they asked us to sing songs of Jerusalem, and they said, how can we do that? The pain of exile is too much. They're not going to sing for their captors. Though living in Babylon, our hearts are in Jerusalem, as is the heart of the preachers. Rumour has come through of a Persian army that's having victory after victory over our hated captors. It's indeed comforting to hear the man of God tell us that Yahweh hasn't forgotten us and that at last he wants to speak tenderly to us and assure us that we're forgiven. We're like soldiers who've been engaged in battle and now at last we've served our term. It's time to go home. Isaiah 40, verse 3. A voice cries, and you know this so well, in the wilderness, prepare the way for Yahweh. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley will be lifted up, every mountain and hill be made low, the uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places are plain. We exiles, we've been thinking of Yahweh as being somehow back there in Judah, from where we have become exiles. Could it be true that Yahweh is going to appear here among us? That's one of the key themes of Ezekiel, the prophet, who's at this same time. Is he going to appear among us here in this foreign land, victorious over the gods of Babylon? We've seen the locals leveling the road in preparation for the procession of their gods, their idols. Now the preacher is telling us, no, we're going to make preparations for the coming of our God, Yahweh. The text. Then the glory of Yahweh shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. God cannot be seen. God is beyond the created world and cannot be contained within it. Yet we know too that our God fills the whole universe. We, I'm imagining us as there in Babylon, we're being assured that while we cannot see Yahweh, his glory will be revealed through what he is going to do among us. Others too will see it and marvel at the presence and action of our God. In case this proves too much for us to believe, the preacher adds, "The mouth of Yahweh has spoken." Once again insisting that he's not speaking for himself, but is moved to speak by God. And the text continues, a voice says, "Cry out." And someone says, "Well, what are we going to cry?" And this is the message. All people are grass. Their constancy is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of Yahweh blows upon it. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. A text quoted in the first letter of Peter, chapter 1. So obviously the New Testament Jewish Christians, this is their Bible, this is what they're reading all the time. The mission we're about to be given doesn't depend on us. We're fragile, it's true. But then so is Babylon. Borrowing an image from the great prophet Isaiah ben Amos, the preacher assures us that all human power and pretension is no more permanent than the grass or the flower of the field. What matters is the will of God. His word, coming to us through his prophets, will not wither or fade. It will stand forever. Three times in this opening oration, stress has been laid on the reliability of God's prophetic word. This assurance given here at the beginning is repeated at the end of the material we'll do it tomorrow. And it's a central theme of the section of the Isaiah scroll we're now entering. Here's how it ends. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there until they've watered the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes out from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose and succeed in the thing for which I have sent it. So between the verses we've just looked at and that verse, we've got all this extraordinarily beautiful material full of hope and promise and forgiveness and comfort. Isaiah 40, verse 9 reads, "Get you up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good tidings." Good tidings is evangelion in Greek, gospel. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem. They're shouting across the desert to their brothers and sisters back in the herald of good tidings. Lift it up. Don't fear. Say to the cities of Judah, hey, here is your God. See, the Lord Yahweh comes with might, and his strong arm asserts his rule. His reward is with him, his recompense before him. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom and gently lead the mother sheep. Language that's perfect for the farmers left eking out an existence in Judah without leadership or all of that. They're being inspired to hope. Jerusalem, called Zion, is being summoned to break the good news to the villages and settlements of Judah that their God has not abandoned them, but is coming back now in strength. And the text continues, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span and closed the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of Yahweh, or as his counselor has instructed him? Whom did he consult for his enlightenment? Who taught him the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Comment, as will become clear later, the preacher is contrasting Yahweh with the Babylonian creator god Marduk. And Marduk is presented as having counsel and help from others. Not so Yahweh. And back to Isaiah. Even the nations are like a drop from a bucket. They're counted as dust on the scales. See, he takes up the isles like fine dust. Lebanon would not provide fuel enough, nor are its animals enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before Yahweh. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. I've just got the Hebrew word there that he uses, tohu. Jeremiah has a phrase, tohu vabohu. And actually that's the text used in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. The whole of everything that existed is tohu vabohu, emptiness. And then there's the Spirit hovering over the chaos, and God says, let there be light. So the authors of Genesis are borrowing this language from the poets. Yahweh took the formless void and brought forth the universe. If Yahweh can create and rule creation, surely the nations who are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness cannot thwart the will of God. That's the point in making. And the text continues, to whom then will you compare me? Who is my equal? Says the Holy One. A question is included in the Hebrew scriptures in the word Michael, as you probably know. Mi is who, ka is like, el. Mikael, who is like God. That's the leading angel after the fall of Lucifer in that battle of the spiritual world. Well, who can you compare to God? The Holy One. The preacher is challenging the claim made by the Babylonians for their God, Marduk. And here's a quote from the Enuma Elish, their statement of their faith, where they say, the Babylonians are saying, None among the gods can equal Marduk. And they would have heard this. Now the preachers are reminding them, no, they've got it wrong. No one can compare to Yahweh. And then he satirizes the idols of that they've witnessed. They've watched the processions. They've probably been forced to be part of it. I don't know. So they know all this that's going on. And this is an idol, says the preacher to the assembled Jews in the synagogue. A workman casts it. A goldsmith overlays it with gold, casts for it silver chains. As a gift, one chooses mulberry wood, wood that will not rot. Then seek out a skilled artisan to set up an image that will not topple. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain, who spreads them like the tent to live in, who brings princes to naught, and makes the rulers of the earth as nothing. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth, when he, our God, the temple singers, Yahweh, when he blows upon them and they wither, and the tempest carries them off like stubble. To whom then can you compare me? Who is my equal, Yahweh, says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. He who brings out their host, the stars, and numbers them, calling them all by name, because he's great in strength, mighty in power, not one is missing. The significance of these words proclaimed in the synagogue in Babylon to the Jewish exiles. The significance of these words is clearer when we recall how important astronomy was in Babylon. The heavenly bodies were considered to be alive. They were composed of the finest element, fire, and were considered gods and worshipped. We're reminded of the fact that they belong to Yahweh. It's Yahweh who names them. And that they journey through the heavens at Yahweh's command. And the text goes on. Why do you say, O Jacob? Why do you speak, O Israel? My way is hidden from Yahweh. My right is disregarded by my God. We can all feel like that. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Yahweh is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding cannot be fathomed. He gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. Even youths will faint and be weary, and the young will fall exhausted. Those who wait for, attend on, wait for Yahweh will renew their strength. They'll fly with renewed wings like eagles. They run and not be weary, walk and not faint. At the same time, not exactly sure when, you've got that marvellous statement in Deuteronomy going back to the original exile in Egypt. And you've got a God saying, how did we ever get here to the mountain of God? I carried you on my wings and bore you across the desert on eagle's wings. Here it is again. God is going to take us from Babylon now on eagle's wings home. That's chapter 40, now chapter 41, and then I'll conclude with that. Listen to me in silence, coastlands. Let the peoples renew their strength. Let them approach. Let them speak. Let us together draw near for judgment. Who has roused a victor from the east? Cyrus summoned him to his service. He delivers up nations to him and tramples kings under his foot. He scatters them with his sword like dust, like wind-driven stubble with his bow. He pursues them and passes on safely, scarcely touching the path with his feet. Who has performed and done this? The one who summons the generations from the beginning. I, Yahweh, I am He, the first and the last. I am He, Hebrew, Ani, who? Greek, Ego, Eimi. A phrase that's going to echo all the way through John's Gospel. Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I've chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from his father's corners, saying to you, you are my servant. I've chosen you and have not cast you off. Servant is in relation to Lord, one who does the will of the Lord, handmaiden, if it's a woman of the Lord. So the servant is carrying out, watching for the hand of the mistress or the master, and then carrying out the master's will. So in the Bible, Abraham is called the servant of Yahweh. So is Moses. So is Israel. And our text continues, do not fear, because some of the people were afraid, I suppose. They got used to being in Babylon. They'd settled down, and they were starting to make a bit of a life for themselves and their children. And the thought of going back to Judah, which they last saw, was absolutely devastated across the desert. And by the way, most of them didn't go home. Most of them gave in to this fear and stayed settled. So here's the temple singers in the synagogue trying to encourage us now, we've got to put ourselves in now. Don't fear. I am with you. Don't be afraid. I'm your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my victorious right hand. For I, Yahweh, your God, hold your right hand. It's I who say to you, don't fear. I'm here to help you. Don't fear, you worm Jacob, you insect Israel. There's going to be a metamorphosis taking place here. The butterfly is going to come out of the chrysalis. Don't fear. I'll help you, says Yahweh, your Redeemer. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Redeemer goes right back to Egypt. It's the price paid to liberate a slave. When the poor and needy seek water, and there's none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, Yahweh, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. It's up to us, of course, to apply this to our lives, and I'm sure you're all doing that quite readily. 41:18 continues, I will open rivers on the bare heights, fountains in the midst of the valleys. I'll make the wilderness a pool of water. They're afraid of the desert. Well, don't be afraid. God's going to make pools of water there for us. The dry land will become springs of water. I'll put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle and the olive. I'll set in the desert the cypress, the plane and the pine together so that all may see and know. All may consider and understand that the hand of Yahweh has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. I've underlined the word create, bara in Hebrew. It's only used of God, the only possible subject for bara, and it means to create. So here you've got the Creator. And to conclude, and then a piece of music, Isaiah, the rest of chapter 41, talks about the gods of the Babylon being useless. And I'll just select three passages which sum up the chapter. You're nothing, say the temple singers. Your work is nothing at all. I, the first, declared it to Zion, and I give Jerusalem a herald of good tidings. And the concluding words, when I looked, there was no one. Among these, there was no counselor who, when I asked, could give an answer. No, they're all nothing. Their works are inexistent. These are the powerful Babylonians he's talking about. Their images are a passing wind, empty chaos. So get ready to come home. Have the courage to do it. And I'll play for you.